Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry. Reports of hate crimes have spiked around the country. They've also spiked here in New York City.
Right now, hate crimes in the city is up 35% from last year.
NYPD Chief Robert Boyce.
We also started looking at certain parameters. What happened post-election day? We had a huge spike right after the election day. It somewhat slowed a little bit. So right now, since election day, is 43 cases versus 20. They're up 23, which is a big percentage, up 115%. We've seen most of those are anti-Semitic, 24 versus 8. The Muslim anti-Muslim number is 4 versus 2, but this is yesterday's number, so we don't have all the weekend. So we're seeing anti-white as well and anti-sexual orientation. So we're seeing across the board an increase right now.
Do I blame Donald Trump for using hate speech during his campaign? Absolutely.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio.
You can't have a candidate for president single out groups of Americans negatively and not have some ramification for that, not have something that happens as a result of that. It's not a surprise. There's been a huge uptick in hate crimes. It's very troubling. Look, a few times recently, the president-elect has spoken out against it. I think he needs to keep doing that. But it's obviously connected to the election, and it's dangerous. It's dangerous. It's, you know, we thank God in most of these cases it's reduced to just speech or threats. But sometimes there's going to be people who follow through on those threats. We could lose lives because of this. And so the temperature has to be brought down. We're going to do that by showing positive examples to people. And this is part of what I said at Cooper Union. New York City is going to be an example to this country of people working together across all faiths, all backgrounds. We're going to do that by upholding positive examples of some of those who have been denigrated. That's why Officer El Sakari is someone I hope all Americans get to know her story and think a little bit about this.
De Blasio is referring to a Muslim police officer. She was threatened in Brooklyn over the weekend by a man who told her to go back to her country. This while she was off duty. Meanwhile, Trump has denied that his proposals on immigration and restrictions on Muslims entering the U.S. amounted to hate speech. In other news, New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo has launched an investigation into racial bias in the state prison system. This follows an extensive investigation by the New York Times. The newspaper reports that black prisoners were punished at higher rates and subjected to solitary confinement more often than white inmates. The Times' report looked at nearly 60,000 disciplinary cases from last year. It found that black inmates at one upstate prison were four times more likely than white prisoners to be sent to isolation. The paper also found that blacks were held in solitary for longer periods than their white counterparts. Governor Cuomo said he directed the state inspector general to look at the allegations and recommend immediate changes. He called the Times' report disturbing. Turning to the presidential election recount in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, 23 of the 72 counties reported that they completed the recount. So far, Donald Trump picked up 146 votes. Trump beat Clinton in Wisconsin by 22,000 votes. Paper ballot counting continues. In Michigan, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein may be forced to pay the entire cost of Michigan's statewide recount. This is under a bill passed today by the Republican-controlled House Election Committee. It approved legislation which would require any candidate who loses by more than 5 percentage points to pay 100% of estimated recount costs. That would total $5 million. The Republican state representative who sponsored the bill said taxpayers shouldn't foot the bill for frivolous recounts. So far in Michigan, recounts have begun, including in Detroit, where there has been suspected voter suppression. The recount effort is spearheaded by Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein.
It looks to me like a rigged election. The election is being rigged by corrupt media pushing completely false allegations and outright lies in an effort to elect her president.
President-elect Trump on the campaign trail. Author and NYU professor Mark Crispin Miller, speaking at a rally on the voter recount, says Trump is right when he says the election can be rigged, but he says the unexpected outcome raises red flags.
After that astonishing victory, as the New York Times called it, election integrity activists looked into that big surprise and did find considerable evidence that that outcome may have been the result of rampant vote suppression and election fraud. There were stark discrepancies between the exit poll results and the official numbers in five states beyond the margin of error, and all of those discrepancies benefited Donald Trump. All over the world, that kind of thing is instantly recognized as a red flag justifying further investigation. There is nothing un-American about that. There is nothing anti-democratic about that. On the contrary, there were also 75,000 undervotes, that is, ballots filled out completely except for the presidential vote, mostly in Democratic precincts in and near Detroit, another red flag. The team in Wisconsin has found that the voting seals, the protective security seals on a number of voting machines, have been broken. This is evidence of fraud. On top of that, now, we have Donald Trump and his team fighting tooth and nail to shut down the recounts. Frankly, I don't understand that. It seems to me that if he won fair and square, he would crave an opportunity to prove that he won fair and square. So I think he should let the recounts proceed. Let me also say to people who think that Jill Stein's effort to get these recounts going in these three states is a covert effort to install Hillary Clinton, I want to note, first of all, Democrats never contest election outcomes, even when they were obviously robbed. Al Gore didn't do it. John Kerry didn't do it. Russ Feingold hasn't done it in Wisconsin, and happened to him twice. Democrats always bend over for it. That is wrong. They should have done what Donald Trump threatened to do in the event that he lost, okay? Well, there's also the fact, just to be clear about this being about voting rights, this not being about any party or about any candidate, that Rocky De La Fuente, another presidential candidate, has filed for a recount in Nevada, which Hillary won narrowly. And he's done this for the sake of our election system, to make sure that our votes are all fairly counted, okay? There's also the fact that Hillary Clinton got her party's nomination as a result of rampant vote suppression and election fraud. And the evidence for this is all laid out in an authoritative report called Democracy Lost from Election Justice USA. I strongly recommend it to everybody.
Mark Crispin Miller speaking at a rally outside Trump Tower about the presidential election recount being led by Dr. Jill Stein and the Green Party. Mark Crispin Miller is a professor at NYU. He's the author of many books, including Fooled Again, The Real Case for Electoral Reform. He is also the editor of Loser Take All, Election Fraud and the Subversion of Democracy. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. In other news, there's a win for environmentalists and for New York residents in the effort to shut down Indian Point. Indian Point nuclear reactors prone to shutdowns are so close to New York City and Buchanan, New York, only 25 miles north of the city, where no escape plan in the event of a meltdown is really possible. But this week, there's a win in an effort to shut down the reactors. WBAI's Ken Gale reports.
Another victory for environmental activists, the air, and the Hudson River. The two Indian Point nuclear power plants, which are operating without a license a little north of New York City, operate at temperatures of several thousand degrees Fahrenheit. They need about 2.5 billion gallons of cooling water every day, about the same amount of water as what all of New York City uses in one day. They've been using the Hudson River, and that water becomes radioactive, very hot, kills fish, and otherwise goes against over a dozen policies designed to protect the Hudson River and its surrounding communities. Though New York State could have denied Indian Point access years ago, it is only now, during the relicensing process, that the state has denied them the river. Entergy, the owner of Indian Point, sued to continue to use the Hudson. The New York State Court of Appeals ruled unanimously in favor of the state against Entergy, which means the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will have to consider the state's objections to the use of the Hudson River as part of its licensing decision. But they're not closed yet. Lawyer Michelle Lee with the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition.
I was actually very surprised by the recent New York Court of Appeals ruling. And it is a win, but one that has the caveat, which is that the U.S. Commerce Secretary, which is an executive appointee and is likely to be Wilbur Ross, can overrule the New York Court of Appeals decision here. And this is one of the very Indian Point relevant consequences of the election. Nevertheless, the New York win, the Court of Appeals, threw a very big monkey wrench into the gears of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's push to get Indian Point relicensed to operate for 20 more years. So the reality of this is that the decision buys time, and it sends a signal to the financial markets, perhaps about the risk inherent in nuclear industry-tied investments, which is significant. People should know that New York has been fighting relicensing of Indian Point for nearly a decade now in proceedings before the Atomic Safety Licensing Board, ASLB, which is an advisory body to the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And the ASLB hearings are ongoing thanks to findings earlier this year of degraded baffle bolts at Indian Point. You know, baffle bolts are large bolts that are in the huge baffle plates within the plant's reactor cooling system. So the finding of deteriorated bolts is actually very significant from a point of nuclear safety.
And that's just one of many accidents at Indian Point. It has about an accident every other month.
It does. Indian Point is a gift that keeps on giving, which is why every time we have what seems to be a loss in the fight against relicensing, pretty soon, within about a month, some incident happens at the plant and we're back in the battle fray. And the ASLB process inserts another very independent and significant monkey wrench into the gears as well. That's likely to continue sometime in 2017.
So, Michelle, just how harmful has Indian Point been?
On the aquatic systems and putting aside issues of public safety and security and all that, it has a huge negative impact on the Hudson River. And this is actually rather startling, what I'm going to say. But it's true. The heat, thermal pollution imposed by Indian Point is the equivalent of from a heat point of view, not radioactivity, from a heat point of view, of detonating an atomic bomb in the river every day. Moreover, the volume of water used by Indian Point, and be aware that nuclear reactors are the heaviest exploiters of water systems of any kind of thermoelectric plant. Coal uses a lot, gas plants use a lot of water, nuclear plants use substantially more water. And to get a sense of that, Indian Point uses, in terms of volume of water sucking into its cooling systems, the volume of the Hudson River all the way from Troy, New York, down to New York City, point where the Hudson and the ocean join. So that the volume is just staggering. And the cooling systems suck in aquatic life. So that's where you get the 2.5 billion. You have fish, larvae, eggs, other kinds of aquatic life get sucked in, impinged, killed. And because of the thermal pollution, which is this heat plume that gets pumped out as the cooling water is discharged after going around the super, super hot nuclear fuel, that water then creates thermal pollution, which is particularly dangerous in a warming world, right? One of the reasons we don't want climate change is because we don't want hot waters, because hot waters create algae plumes. They create oxygen deprivation. They severely strain the metabolic systems of fish and aquatic life. And, of course, heat alters the entire ecosystem. And this is happening in ways, honestly, scientists don't even understand yet.
Michelle, what does this victory mean on the federal level?
Well, on the federal level, it means that it has to go back to, to the federal level. The NRC, by law, by its own regulations, needs to consider it. Does that mean the NRC has to listen to it? No. And then you're back in an issue of potentially New York battling the NRC over the ruling. This is uncharted terrain. What's happened at Indian Point, starting back 15 years ago, is all uncharted terrain. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is doing everything it can to get the reactor relicensed. New York and environmental groups and citizen groups are fighting against the relicensing. How that will play out, nobody knows.
And the State Pollutant Discharge Elimination System went all the way up to the Supreme Court a few years ago, and Entergy lost that one.
Yes, they lost that battle, and the NRC, under its own rules and regulations, is supposed to not relicense reactors if the states, because of the state's rights under the Clean Water Act, where states are given the right to protect their own coastal waters. This isn't a nuclear issue. This is a coastal water protection issue. The NRC, in its 2013 draft generic environmental impact statement, said that states have the authority to over the Clean Water Act and to grant or deny what are called speedies permits, which has to do with state pollutant discharge elimination system permits. But again, the NRC can then just decide to disavow its own regulations and do whatever it pleases.
Lawyer Michelle Lee with the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition. And Trump's proposed Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, has spoken out in favor of new nuclear power plants, and we can only assume that he would also want to prop up the old ones. Trump himself has spoken out in favor of nuclear power and basically just disregards all the accidents and releases of radiation into the air and water. So little of Indian Point electricity goes to New York City, and we have so much extra generating capacity thanks to all the efficiency measures New Yorkers have been using that we don't need Indian Point's electricity anyway, and we don't need to put up with the constant danger from these aging, accident-prone plants. Ken Gale, WBAI News, New York.
Ken Gale is host of WBAI's long-running environmental program, EcoLogic. You can hear it this evening and every Tuesday evening beginning at 8 p.m. In South Carolina, a jury declared a mistrial in the murder case of a white police officer who shot and killed African-American Walter Scott in the back. The shooting was caught by a bystander's cell phone video, and it shocked the nation. WBAI's Rebecca Miles has more.
The jury of 11 whites and one African-American had already deliberated for more than 17 hours over 4 days before calling a mistrial on Monday.
Mr. Foreman, members of the jury, I received a note that says we as a jury regret to inform the court that despite the best efforts of all members, we are unable to come to a unanimous decision in the case of the state versus Michael Slager. Is that correct, Mr. Foreman?
Yes, sir.
All right, well, the court therefore must declare a mistrial in this case, and I so declare that this case is mistried.
The mistrial was declared in the murder case against Michael Slager, the white former North Charleston police officer charged with murdering black motorist Walter Scott. Police officer Slager pulled over Scott's Mercedes for a broken taillight on April the 4th, 2015. Scott ran away, and Slager said a scuffle ensued after he pursued Scott on foot. Slager said Scott attempted to wrest away the officer's taser, and that's when he shot Scott out of fear for his own life. Cell phone footage shows Slager firing 8 times until Scott collapses, then Slager reporting shots fired on his radio and walking over and demanding, "Put your hands behind your back," and handcuffing Scott. Slager was fired from the force and charged with murder within days of the release of the cell phone video. Slager's lawyer had asked for a mistrial last week after jurors said they were deadlocked. Outside the court, Judy Scott, Walter's mother, reacted.
"I'm not sad. And I want you to know why I'm not sad. Because Jesus is on the inside. And I know that justice will be served. It's not over. Y'all hear me? It's not over. So God say it's over."
All of us know that was murder.
Walter's brother, Anthony, said the family wants to see justice before there's forgiveness.
"In my heart, I will find the peace to forgive Michael Slager for doing that, what he done to my brother. But at this present time, until my family can see justice, no, there's no forgiveness."
A note handed to the court on Monday revealed the majority of jurors were undecided about a verdict in the case. The note included a number of questions about why was voluntary manslaughter added as a charge, and how long must someone have malice in their mind towards someone to be convicted of murder. Jurors were also seeking whether the definition of self-defense for a police officer was different to that of the average person. Slager is awaiting trial in federal court, charged with violating Scott's rights, obstruction of justice, and a gun violation. Chris Stewart, the family's attorney, said the case will be tried again.
"The fight isn't over. That was round one. We've got 2 more rounds to go. The solicitor is trying this case again as soon as she can. The DOJ is trying this case as soon as they can. He may have delayed justice, but he did not escape it."
The city of North Charleston agreed to pay $6.5 million settlement to the Scott family. Rebecca Miles, WBAI News, New York.
As we reported, Fidel Castro has now been buried and he lives in history. His ashes were encased in a large granite boulder on Sunday, ending 9 days of public mourning, literally setting in stone the legacy of one of the 20th century's most influential players. During the mourning period, the world witnessed massive public outpourings in Cuba's cities, especially Havana and Santiago de Cuba, where the funeral ceremony took place. Here in New York, during Sunday's memorial vigil outside the Cuban mission to the United Nations, WBAI Sally O'Brien spoke with Cuba's Deputy UN Ambassador, Ana Rodriguez.
While at least 300 supporters held a memorial gathering outside the Cuban mission on Sunday, officials at the mission opened their doors for those assembled to come in and sign a book of condolences. It was then that Deputy Permanent UN Representative Ana Rodriguez spoke with me.
"As every Cuban, we feel very sad for the passing of our commander-in-chief, of our leader, but I think that we have to also look forward. If you see all the manifestation in Cuba, all the square, in every place, all the Cubans are saying we are Fidel. And this is what we have to look for the future. Fidel has to be multiplied. Multiply in every Cuban, in every person of the solidarity. We cannot sit down and cry because he died. We have to stand up. We have to stand up and continue fighting and working and spreading his legacy."
And I think that that's something that the concept of this, people in the United States may not really understand, that while Fidel Castro was a leader and a very important leader of the revolution, that it was Fidel Castro, the July 26th movement, and the Cuban people. And as you were coming up and then beginning to do your studies for diplomatic service and all of that, I'm wondering, personally, what kind of example and what you learned from Fidel?
Fidel was a man of principle. And this is something that we as a diplomat carry out in all our function. We always at the United Nations stand defending our principle. And it doesn't matter if you are a big country or a small country. The most important thing that every Cuba learned from Fidel is that we have to defend and fight for our principle.
I know that it must have been a very strange and in some way a schizophrenic week, as you received, I'm sure, a lot of support at the United Nations because the October resolution to end the blockade on Cuba showed just how much the international community respects and loves Cuba and the Cuban Revolution. And yet that contrasted against what the U.S. and a lot of the Western media was saying about Fidel Castro. And I'm wondering how you negotiated that with people showing support and love, and on the other side, the media being so aggressive.
It's true that the media have been so aggressive, but we put aside the media because the media cannot deny what is happening now. What is happening all around the world, if you see all the pictures of showing of solidarity with the Cuban people, showing how people feel the passing of Fidel, and they really feel it, because when you see the face of the people, you realize that they are together with the Cuban people, in solidarity with the Cuban people, supporting us. And I think also saying to our people, we are with you in this moment of sorrow, in this moment of sadness, we are with you, and you can count on us. And I think that the media that talk bad about Cuba, what the legacy of Fidel Castro, they try to deny what is happening. Havana have 2 million of people. I think in the Revolution Square, at least 1 million was there. Nobody can deny that this is a people that is supporting his leader, and they are mourning his leader, is crying his leader, but also are telling his leader and the Cuban government that we are going to continue fighting, we are going to continue carry on the legacy of our commander-in-chief.
As you were growing up and you grew up in the revolution, mm-hmm. you had many wonderful and strong leaders that you could look up to, women and men, and yet Fidel stands out. And what do you think that you learned most from Fidel Castro?
I learned from him to be a better revolutionary. I learned from him not to only think about me, but to look for others. I learned from him the importance to fight and stand up for our principle. I learned from him to share. I learned from him the solidarity. I think that the most important thing than the legacy that Fidel gave us and left to us is to be a better revolutionary every day. Every day. And when maybe for any reason we are weak, I think that we have to think on him, and we have to think what the causes that he fight for are, the causes of the poor people, the workers, those people that have been ignored for many years. Also, I learned from him the compassion, the solidarity, the need to cooperate with others, that it doesn't matter that maybe we don't have too much, but we can share what we have. And this is also a very important sentiment. Very nice example of this is all the Cuban brigade that we have all along different countries in Africa, in Latin America, when we decided to go and fight Ebola. And ELAM, the Latin American School of Medicine, is the example that we care. And this is one of his masterpieces. The Latin American School of Medicine. We say Latin America because it was the previous name, but in that school study students from all over the world, and we don't have too many resources, but we decided we are going to open a school, and the students from all over the world that came from very poor families, to help them to become doctors in order that they can go to their country and help also the population. And I think that those are the main legacy that Fidel Castro gave me, and I owe to carry on his legacy.
And Fidel lives in the hearts and minds, and viva Fidel.
Long live our commander-in-chief.
Ana Rodriguez is Cuba's deputy ambassador to the United Nations. Sally O'Brien, WBAI News, New York.
And that's the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, December 6, 2016. The news was produced with Ken Gale, Rebecca Miles, Sally O'Brien, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.